It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, civilian casualties are mounting in Russia's war against Ukraine. We'll look at the latest developments with an expert on armed conflict and foreign policy. First, rent is rising around the United States. According to the real estate firm Redfin, the average rental listing sits at almost $1,900 a month. That's up 14% from last year. Cities like Miami, Austin, and New York are being hit the hardest. But Wisconsin renters are seeing monthly costs go up as well. Rents have increased by as much as 10% in some communities. We'll talk about why rent is higher than usual, how it's affecting renters, and what kind of help might be out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your experience with housing. Are you struggling to find a place in your price range? Do you see rent going up in your area? Is the housing you can afford safe for your family? If you rent to people, what kind of things are driving costs up for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Andy Height is the Housing Policy and Program Manager with the Wisconsin Community Action Program, or WISCAP. Andy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here on public radio.
Can you give us a sense, Andy, of what renters are facing here in Wisconsin? What kind of things are you hearing from people?
It is a multifaceted, burgeoning nightmare for a lot of people, Rob. The American Recovery Plan Act and other pandemic relief programs have allowed up to 18 months of rent assistance. And it's been a very generous program that covers back rent up to 3 months, forward rent at a time, utilities for water, gas, electric, even internet. But we are in month 24, month 25 of the pandemic. So people that were really deeply impacted are running out of months of assistance, or they've run out, and you combine that with the eviction moratorium expiring and the wave of rent increases that has been occurring since approximately August and is now settling into people's financial reality. We've got a truly imperfect storm that people are facing.
Seen a lot of factors nationally leading to these rent increases. What are you seeing drive the acceleration of rent in Wisconsin, Andy?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things. There's a major shortage in permanent affordable housing everywhere in this state for people at the lowest income. A, B, you know, capitalism is a thing. Landlords want to make profits. Their taxes and expenses are going up. They're raising their rents above the rate of inflation to, I don't know, continue to maximize their investment in many cases. So the city of Green Bay has seen 10% rent increases. Winnebago County, the apartment association there is reporting 30% rent increases. In Appleton, it's 31%. I was working with a disabled man up in Oshkosh. His rent went from $570 a month. New owner bought his unit. His rent is now $840 a month. That's more than his monthly SSI payment. Not sure how we're going to maneuver. There's the faith-based community used to fill a lot of gaps in the safety net. And because of the fairly generous amount of public funding, it's taken some pressure off those faith-based resources. But behind that reality is a wave of need that's going to overwhelm the faith-based and private sector funding that could fill the gaps when these program eligibility months start to wane for people.
Talking to Andy Height, Housing Policy and Program Manager with the Wisconsin Community Action Program, or WISCAP, looking at rent increases all over the country, including here in Wisconsin. You can join us if you have a story to share as a renter, a would-be renter, or someone who rents out housing yourself. What are you seeing when it comes to rent prices around the state? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rebecca is with us in Green Bay. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, I am just calling. I wanted to share a story. I have been living in a duplex for 2.5 years now, and single mother with two kids. and knew my lease was coming up and just called the landlord and said, just wanted to make sure you were looking at renewing. And he did let me know that he was planning to renew the lease, but he was raising the rent by $500.
Raising the rent by $500? Not $500, by $500.
No, by $500, a 33% increase. And he had nothing to say about it other than, I have to make money.
Rebecca, what's your plan now? Are you looking for another place? Are you going to be able to pay that higher cost? What's next?
There is no way I'm going to be able to pay that higher cost. And we have desperately been looking for the last 2 months. And it is really one of these, it's sort of like trying to buy a house right now. There is very little available. And when something does become available, there are multiple applications that are coming in. And I have a fairly good income, but they're just flying off. That to be able to find one is next to impossible. I'm looking for 2 months and still haven't secured anything.
Rebecca, good luck. And thanks for sharing your story. Andy.
I mean, Rebecca, I empathize with the horror of that situation. I mean, $500 a month, I would be surprised if the property taxes increased $500 in a year, even with an increase in valuation of the property. $500 a month is, pardon my awful math, but isn't that $6,000 a year increase? I wonder, and there isn't much housing stock, but is there a first-time home buyer program that might fit? Can the Community Action Agency in your neck of the woods, NUCAP, provide some case management assistance in finding housing? When I said there was an imperfect storm, Rob, there are a lot of people who would be buying homes that are locked out because of a lack of homes for sale on the market and the incredible upward trend in the pricing of homes on the market. So they're sitting in apartment units and there just aren't available units. I thought I heard that Wisconsin is lacking 118,000 affordable units across the state. And when I talk about affordable housing, I'm talking about people from 0% of the median income to 30% of the median income. But it's just as bad up to 50% of the median income. And we're seeing thousands upon thousands of households that are rent burdened, where they're paying well over 35% of their income, sometimes more than half their income for rent. And it doesn't take much of a disruption to teeter on the brink of financial ruin because wages just aren't increasing commensurate with the cost of housing.
Rebecca, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in Wabino. Chris, hi.
Hello, yes, I'm Chris from Wabino, and I'm trying to keep my rent down. I haven't raised it any of my renters, but just the sheer price of trying to fix things up after they move out because they've wrecked the security deposit, never even come close to the cost of fixing the stuff. And you know, there's a lot of reasons why a person's raising their rent. Some of us is great, I understand that, but some of us are really struggling when people move out, they destroy things so much. That's what all I got to say about it.
Well, and Chris, before you go, though, I've heard landlords, like anybody else who's doing any construction-related project, they're in some cases facing higher costs of raw materials or labor. Is that part of your story when you're trying to fix up?
Yes, absolutely. The price of lumber has skyrocketed, and labor has went up but very little for my neck of the woods, at least. I feel sorry for my renters because the wages have been stagnant. That's why I'm trying not to raise my rent, but it's pretty hard. You know, I'm trying to make a profit, not trying to make a killing, but I'm trying to make somewhat of a profit to put in my pocket. I'm taking risks like any other business owner.
Chris, thanks for sharing your story. Andy, I think that's especially maybe for smaller landlords, this is going to be a pretty common story that material costs, labor costs are leading them to want to or to have to increase rent, as Chris said, even though he doesn't really want to.
That's part of this storm. Chris sounds like the kind of landlord we need more of, to be honest. I don't know how to explain people trashing apartments. That makes no sense to me. I think the relationship that people forge as landlords and tenant does not have to be adversarial. We're all people. We may all be bozos on the same bus listening to the same music. But the reality is, can we work together to make things unfold positively? And if people are trashing your homes and you have to spend money to get them back in shape and rent them, that's a totally understandable form of rent increase. And I don't have an answer for human imperfection. I just think if there's relationships, positive relationships established, we have a better chance of getting through this together. I've seen landlords go to bat for vulnerable tenants with disabilities or barriers to communication where they've waited and waited to collect their rent so that they could access the rent assistance programs that were out there because they believed in them and wanted to keep them in housing. I would guess that in those kinds of cases, those renters are unlikely to trash an apartment, but it's an interesting world.
Thanks for sharing your story. We're talking to Andy Height. Andy's the Housing Policy and Program Manager with the Wisconsin Community Action Program. With us today to look at what's causing rent to increase in Wisconsin, what that means for housing affordability in communities around the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing a big share of your income, more than you'd like, go toward rent? Has rent gone up for you? Maybe created a tough situation figuring out where you're going to live after the lease expires. If you own properties that you rent out, what do you see driving the costs for you? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look now at the rising cost of rent in Wisconsin, looking at why it's getting higher, what renters can do. Andy Height is with us from the Wisconsin Community Action Program. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a tough time finding affordable housing, rent, or if you're looking to buy a house for that matter, because that is part of the story, or if you've been successful, rents are reasonable in your neck of the woods. Love to hear from you. If you rent to others, what is driving your costs right now? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Andy, for somebody in a housing crisis situation right now, their lease is ending, say, and they can't afford that higher rent now, they don't have a place, or maybe even somebody who's facing high costs of owning a house, what kind of resources are out there? What are some first steps they could take?
The first step, if you're seeking housing, I would start at your local community action agency. You can go to WISCAP, WISCAP.org, and look at the map for Wisconsin Emergency Rent Assistance and find the agency administering the program in your area and ask about housing navigation. If you need emergency rent assistance, you can call the local agencies directly, because they can hook you up with all of the other anti-poverty programs they're running, or you can call our partner at Energy Services, who's running the statewide rent assistance hotline at 833-900-9372. The last thing I'll mention, Rob, if you are a homeowner and it's your primary residence and you're in financial crisis because of the pandemic, you've lost your job or you lost hours and you're behind on your mortgage or your taxes or your utilities or some combination, you can apply for the just launched today at 1 o'clock by Governor Evers, the Wisconsin Help for Homeowners program. Go to Home Ownership Help. That's homeownershiphelp.wisconsin.gov. That's homeownershiphelp.wi.gov, not the full spelling of Wisconsin. Sorry about that. There are resources out there. If you're in a house, we want to do everything we can to keep people in those homes. There just isn't enough permanent affordable housing, Rob, and we need to see the state, counties, municipalities, towns, cities invest in partnership with nonprofits in permanent affordable housing. You hear needs for workforce housing. You hear needs for affordable housing from the most rural communities to the most urbanized communities. and everywhere in between. And if we don't make a concerted effort in investing in this infrastructure, we are just delaying what's going to be a major crisis. Permanent affordable housing is critical to everyone's quality of life, but especially young children and people in vulnerable situations who might have disabilities, mobility issues, cognitive issues, things that just make the day-to-day challenges of this world more difficult. So how do we come together with the sense of neighborhood and community to keep people in their homes while expanding the options? It's not going to be easy in this divide and conquer time, but I think it's a must that we devote time, attention, and resources to it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Courtney is with us in Green Bay. Courtney, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Courtney?
Well, I'm going to say that I'm on both sides of the perspective here, because I have worked for landlords, some big companies that own a lot of stuff here in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And there's two sides of the story. Yes. Do landlords get screwed over when tenants move out? Do they trash the place, and did they lack care and detail while living in there? Absolutely. I see that, and I understand that. But the cost isn't as high as what they're explaining. And their loans have been their loans. Their interests have been their interests. And at the end of the day, they are still making money. So that's kind of iffy and a joke on it to jump your rent so significantly high. Because I'm a single mom and I work really hard and I rent. And I worked for these landlords. And so for me to see, and I also am in the same boat. I paid $955 for a 3-bedroom, 1-bath duplex, and now it's jumping as well. So if you look at the whole big spectrum, I think some people are using this as an excuse to raise the rent to bring more revenue in. Because at the end of the day, these banks are not increasing their interest rates. They're not increasing the loan amount. So they're still making the same amount of profit.
Gotcha.
So that's kind of...
Courtney, thanks for the call. Courtney sees kind of both sides there. Andy, can we dial down the sort of assumption of an adversarial relationship? Should we dial that down?
I think that the first option is to always figure out how to work together. There is no doubt. I would imagine, because of Courtney's experience as a tenant and as a property manager, that Courtney doesn't leave units trashed when she leaves. There is normal wear and tear that happens. I think anyone who rented in a college town knows that no matter how pristine you may leave a unit, the landlord finds a way to take money from their security deposit. It just seemed like a fact of life for people I knew in places like Madison or Milwaukee or Oshkosh or in other states with college towns. And it's just a challenge. How do you establish a relationship when there's a power imbalance? Some people have a better knack for that than others. And once it becomes adversarial, it's very hard to win a power struggle with somebody who is the owner if you're the renter. So how do we avoid it? And again, I think it comes with communication styles and communication willingness in terms of both parties. And that's way easier said than done.
Courtney, thanks for sharing your unique perspective. Talking to Andy Hite from the Wisconsin Community Action Program, talking about the high cost of rent in Wisconsin. Back to your calls now. Nancy is on the line in Milwaukee. Nancy, hello.
Hey, Nancy.
Hello to you. My comment is that I own and live in a very large duplex. I've lived here 46 years. The last time I tried to rent a very large upstairs apartment, a woman and two men came. The woman was married to one man, and she said the other man was his brother. So while I was showing her this very large kitchen, and she was telling me how nice it was, I heard the two brothers say to each other, "We could get 5 sets of bunk beds. These bedrooms are so large." In other words, the brother of the husband was planning on moving his family in too. But, of course, they didn't tell me that. It was just the man and the woman making an application. But when I heard the brother say, "Well, we can get 5 sets of bunk beds in here," I thought to myself, that's all I need is 10 children in an upstairs apartment. So I think a lot of families are going to have to double up because of the high rents. And it is pathetic that our government is not providing housing for returned veterans and for young couples.
Nancy, I got you. We don't have too much time left. Nancy's seeing pressure maybe for big groups of people to go into smaller places than they normally would because of those high rents, Andy.
Sounds like a terrible situation. I don't know. Again, human imperfection is a unique thing, and it's very important to artistic processes, but it makes the tenant-landlord relationships very difficult at times. So I guess how you screen, and when somebody says that, I think it's an important thing to say, well, I'm only renting to the people on, you know, this lease. Who's going to be in here? And, you know, next, please, because I imagine a unit of the quality that Nancy was renting would have a fairly high demand for it. So I've empathized with every caller so far today.
Nancy, thanks for that call. Less than a minute left, Andy. Magic wand, what would be your number one thing to lower rents?
Number one thing is more permanent affordable housing with either a tax credit program or a voucher program where people only have to pay 30% of their income to rent. I think we move away from Section 8 vouchers and towards tax credit vouchers like the child care tax credit that was recently undone by the Senate, where eligible people would have that increment of rent paid directly to the landlord on a monthly basis, right to their savings account. And that might be a way to expand, to keep people in housing while we put our heads down and figure out how to collaborate on expanding the options of permanent affordable housing around the state.
Andy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Andy Height is a housing policy and program manager with the Wisconsin Community Action Program with us today to talk about the rising cost of rent in Wisconsin and what that means for low and middle income renters. By the way, we've got some of the reference info that he mentioned to find info about rent assistance. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to an expert on international relations about the humanitarian crisis being created by Russia's war in Ukraine and concerns about what the fighting means for Ukrainian nuclear power plants. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about the role volunteers play in maintaining and showcasing Wisconsin's state parks, forests, and trails. Now, it's the second week of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and unarmed civilians are being killed by attacks from Russia. Russia is also taking control of two of Ukraine's four nuclear energy facilities, raising concerns from international observers. We're talking about the latest developments in Russia's war against Ukraine, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been following the news about what's happening there, what are your thoughts, your questions, your reactions? How do you think the U.S. should respond, if at all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's an expert on armed conflict, foreign policy, and nuclear weapons. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
Before we get into some specific issues, Andrew, what are your thoughts at this stage now over a week into this invasion?
Well, generally, two big things. One, it's gone much worse for Russia than they anticipated. They thought that, well before now, actually, that they would have had time to secure control of the capital, Kyiv, replace the previous government, the existing current government, with some government to their liking, presumably, and probably capture the other big city in the north, Kharkiv, and basically have secured control of the country. And it's just very far from that happening at this point. Their troops have bogged down. The Ukrainian army has put up a lot of resistance that they didn't anticipate, and the Ukrainian government has shown itself to be incredibly resilient and good at mobilizing not just within Ukraine, but international opposition to the Russian invasion. So very much not what they were hoping for.
You'd said two main things. That one was unexpected resistance, Russia moving slower than expected.
Yeah, definitely moving slower than expected. I mean, they thought they initially invaded with fairly light forces, hoping that they would, I guess, just quickly go in without any big opposition and seize the major objectives, mostly Kyiv, the capital in the north. But they met stiff resistance, and then they had to send in the rest of their forces. They've committed now, it's estimated, 95 to 100% of the forces that they had gathered around Ukraine prior to the invasion. But they are still not making progress. They're still very much bogged down.
One of the main concerns now, or since the beginning, actually, has been the threat to the civilian population in Ukraine. Well over a million people have fled the country already just days into this, and concerns about Russian troops either targeting civilians or indiscriminately firing and endangering civilians. What are you watching for as we see those reports?
Well, two things. One is that you're seeing, I think, and the major one is going to be shelling of large population areas. Again, the capital of Kyiv and Kharkiv in the north are the main battle sites, but also Mariupol in the south, and potentially eventually Odessa could come under attack. So the Russian, once the blitzkrieg, you know, quick victory hopes have faded, the Russians are probably going to resort to the way they fought in Chechnya and the way they fought in Syria more recently, which is to simply use artillery to pound residential areas that are being held by the opposition, regardless of the fact that there are civilians in those areas as well, which will lead to large numbers of civilian casualties and the destruction of those residential areas and buildings. There's also documented episodes of firing upon civilians in more direct ways, people who are fleeing or people who are, you know, identifiable as civilians in the street. And I think that will happen probably less than, but I think in terms of casualties, the main numbers are going to be as a result of this sort of indiscriminate shelling of residential areas.
Talking to Andrew Kidd from UW-Madison, political science professor there, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I just have a question about the sanctions. That's largely like the entire Western response to the situation of just imposing sanctions on Russia. And from you know, my perspective, which is not an expert perspective, it just seems like Russia and China are kind of like buddying up with each other. And I'm kind of worried that, you know, China is just going to sit back and kind of watch what happens. And it might encourage them to kind of carry out the same, you know, attack on Taiwan and in the future. And what I would be curious about that is, it is, would China be as affected by sanctions in that situation? And would that just have the same effect as the sanctions are having on Russia right now?
Chris, thanks for the call. A lot there, Andrew. Let's start with Russia and China, their relationship here, how China has reacted to this invasion.
Sure. So Russia and China were relatively close prior to the invasion. Both shared an antagonism towards the United States and what they perceived as American domination of the world or hegemony. Both pushing back on that, Russia in their vicinity, especially in Ukraine and Eastern Europe, and China in their vicinity, especially Taiwan and the South China Seas. So they shared interests in that regard. So that has been true. However, China has not been exactly vocal in its defense of Russia in this episode. It's not clear that Putin cleared this with China or even let them know significantly beforehand. So the Chinese have not been enthusiastic about it for a whole variety of reasons. And an interesting aspect, I think you've touched upon one aspect, which is the sanctions, right? The Western response to this invasion has been much, much more unified than anyone anticipated it would be, and much stronger, and has imposed much greater costs on Russia. We're now even talking about an oil embargo, like not purchasing Russian energy exports. And basically, when you've got oil and agricultural exports like wheat, that's about it in terms of Russian exports. So those are going to be very severe sanctions. Now, when it comes to China, China is a much, much bigger economy. The Chinese economy is almost as large as the United States economy. And so in some senses, it seems less vulnerable to external pressure. However, it also is heavily integrated with the rest of the world in terms of export markets. They export all kinds of things to the United States and to Western Europe. And if those markets were just shut off over some behavior like invading Taiwan, that could be very catastrophic for the Chinese economy. And I think it sort of sends a message to China that it's not necessarily smart to underestimate the response of Western countries to blatant acts of territorial aggression like this. The Chinese might have thought that they could get away with invading Taiwan. They may still think that. But this episode, I would say, has given them a bit of food for thought there, because the West has been much more vigorous in its response than people anticipated.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think the United States is being very short-sighted. These sanctions really are not working so far. I think China and Russia are playing a long game. And you got to know that they both have discussed this before they made their moves. It's just a big chess game. And I think it's a longer game than we're anticipating. And I just think it's just a human tragedy that we're just sitting by watching all these people get killed on the nightly news, families uprooted and killed and slaughtered. I mean, and it's going to continue. And our response is basically like a cancel culture sort of. And these sanctions, I got to think that they've calculated all of this. They've thought of the worst case scenario. And even though Putin is facing, and I'm glad to see it, I'm glad he's kind of getting his butt kicked. But I think they calculated this. I think they could survive a longer period if they're in for the long run.
Jim, I gotcha. Andrew, sounds like Jim wants more than sanctions. There is lethal military aid now, U.S. and Western countries, all the way over to Poland, sending some lethal aid. The next escalation people have talked about is some kind of no-fly zone preventing Russian aircraft from operating over Ukraine. What do you think of that as an option?
I think that would be a big mistake. So I think it's important to point out that the military aid to Ukraine has been prompt and effective, as far as we can tell. Not just the United States, but many NATO countries and even non-NATO countries like Sweden and Finland have sent the Ukrainians exactly what they need, which is portable, easily carried anti-tank weapons and anti-aircraft weapons, like the Javelin missiles and the Stinger missiles that we've all heard about. Thousands of those have gone into Ukraine over the past week during the course of this invasion, and they are taking a toll on Russian hardware as we speak. And that's really the most important thing that the Ukrainians need to be able to fight this war with some prospect of success. I think if we start talking about a no-fly zone, that involves direct U.S. NATO aircraft flying over Ukrainian airspace and shooting down Russian helicopters, shooting down Russian fixed-wing aircraft, and attacking any anti-aircraft surface-to-air missiles that they might possess as well. So that gets you directly involved in a shooting war between NATO and Russia, which is, of course, a nuclear-armed country, which has as many nuclear weapons as the United States does. And so that would be extremely escalatory and unwise. So I think it's best to help the Ukrainians with sanctions and to help them with military aid, but to recognize that this is Ukraine's war. There is theirs to fight, and hopefully they are able to prevail. But it's not NATO's to fight. It's not our war to fight indirectly. And that would involve extreme risk of nuclear escalation.
Jim, thanks for that call. We're talking about the latest developments in Ukraine with Andrew Kidd. He teaches about foreign policy and armed conflict at UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about the situation at 800-642-1234, what you want to see the U.S. do or not do. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our look at Russia's war in Ukraine. Andrew Kidd stays with us from UW-Madison, political science professor there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Andrew, you mentioned Russia's nuclear arsenal. Vladimir Putin has referenced that. He has put his nuclear forces on alert at one point, or he said he did. He's mentioned that he views the sanctions as an act of war. How worried are you about Putin and nuclear escalation?
Well, I'm somewhat worried, but not worried enough to say that we should stop supplying the Ukrainians with weapons or roll back the sanctions. So, yes, it's true. Russia has a lot of nuclear weapons. The United States has a lot of nuclear weapons. And so a direct NATO-Russia war or even military confrontation would be very risky. On the other hand, if you look historically throughout the Cold War, it was often the case that either the United States or the Soviet Union faced insurgencies, were engaged in wars in Vietnam, in Korea, in Afghanistan, both the Russians and us, where our opponents were supported, the people we were fighting against were supported by the other superpower or by someone else. And we accepted that, right? We didn't use nuclear threats. We didn't attack those countries with nuclear weapons. So, for instance, most recently, when we were fighting in Afghanistan, the Taliban had aid and shelter across the border in Pakistan. We had nuclear weapons. We conceivably could have attacked Pakistan with nuclear weapons, but we never even really considered that. So Putin may make nuclear threats at this point, but I very much doubt that he would push it to the brink over military aid to Ukraine. I think that would be very unusual, very unlikely. Now, it's true, Putin may find himself in desperate straits and may want to escalate, but I'm still fairly confident that he would be very reluctant to do that.
Let's go back to our callers now. Doug is with us in Colfax. Doug, hello.
Hello. Great program as usual. My question is about if there's a reason for optimism. The sanctions have been greater than pretty much anyone expected, even the private sector. Russia is still making pretty good gains in the South. But is there a reason for optimism? Is there a possibility that Putin and the Russian forces would actually back out from this invasion?
Doug, thanks for the call. Andrew?
Yeah, I think the Ukrainian strategy here and their hope for how to win this thing is to bog down the Russians, hit their supply chain so that they can't refuel their vehicles, can't replace vehicles that have been damaged, and gradually wear them down and eventually get them to surrender in small units, then maybe in larger units, increase desertion, increase all kinds of morale problems on the Russian side. And so not necessarily launch like major blitzkrieg-style counteroffensives that drive them out by the point of tanks, but basically make it like a Vietnam or a Afghanistan-style situation that the Russians realize they simply can't win, and they're taking casualties all over the place and eventually decide to give up at some point. I think that's their long-term strategy.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Paul in Evansville. Paul, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about NATO. Why or what is the process for making Ukraine a NATO country and why not? So I guess.
Paul, thanks for the call. Andrew, that was one of Putin's cited reasons, the fear that Ukraine could someday become part of NATO. What would it take for that to happen? I'm assuming probably that wouldn't happen while hostilities are going on there.
Yes, that wouldn't happen during the war, that's for sure. And that was one of the big demands and one of the big fears on the Russian part, that Ukraine would join NATO and the European Union. Don't forget, not just NATO, but the European Union was equally important. because of the economic ties. Well, the process for joining NATO is a very long and involved bureaucratic process, right? It's a big organization. You have to make an application. There's negotiations that take years often. And it's a big political decision as well. And because NATO is an international organization that operates by consensus, every single member of NATO has to approve the addition of new members. So they would have to face quite a lot of hurdles to get in. And typically, one of the criteria is that you have to have no civil war on your territory at the moment, at least, no international conflict that you're involved in, so that NATO doesn't get sort of dragged in right off the get-go into some new war. So Ukraine would have to be at peace. They would have to fill out this application. It would have to go through a long process. And it would also, of course, be a hugely political decision because, you know, from the Russian point of view, that's what this war was all about. On the other hand, from the Ukrainian point of view, this sort of only serves to reinforce and demonstrate the need for Ukraine to be in NATO. And indeed, even other neutral countries like Finland and Sweden, who have historically not been members of NATO and didn't join NATO after the Cold War, are now considering it. And the population in those countries is now trending towards favoring NATO membership. So this may be a really sort of an own goal for Putin in terms of driving exactly the phenomena that he was hoping to prevent.
Thanks for calling in. Marty joins us next in Lake Geneva. Marty, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. So you have a 40-mile-long, supposedly, convoy that is stationary. Why isn't Ukraine just picking them off here and there? It seems like they're sitting ducks. It doesn't seem to me like you'd have to take out the entire convoy. You pick them off here and there, and I can't imagine the boys just not hopping out of the tanks and walking away.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know tactically exactly what's going on there. Maybe that they have established some sort of defensive perimeter around them so that they make them harder to attack. On the other hand, from the Ukrainian perspective, that may be okay and like the least of their concerns at this point. If they are stationary and if they're not being resupplied, if they're not getting the gasoline and the spare parts that they need to move forward, they may be turning their attention to other things that are more pressing at the moment. But I'm not sure exactly what's going on there. But my guess would have to be that the Ukrainians think that threat is contained, at least for now.
Thanks for the call. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I don't know that much about the politics in the Ukrainian area, but I'm wondering if Putin is more interested in just acquiring Ukrainian territory as a buffer against NATO countries and really isn't concerned if he destroys the infrastructure of the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's one argument, although so there's sort of a debate on what exactly Putin's goals are here, and some people think he wants to just install some sort of compliant government, puppet government that will do whatever he says. But others think that he is more ambitious and he actually wants to recreate the Russian Empire and bring Ukraine and Belarus back into a single state that's ruled from Moscow. I tend to lean towards that latter view, which I think may account for the invasion as a whole, of course, but also a certain reluctance to completely destroy the cities so far, unlike with Aleppo in Syria, where, I mean, he couldn't care less about that, or even Grozny in Chechnya back in the Chechen wars. He might not have cared that much about that. He may still be somewhat reluctant to be seen as someone who's engaging in the mass slaughter of his fellow Slavs in Ukraine.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, Andrew, do you see any hope of a negotiated dial down of hostilities and then withdrawal of Russian troops?
Not in the near future, because I think the Russians, although their initial plan has failed, I think they still have hope of winning. And Putin certainly still has hope of winning. And Putin, I think, fears, possibly rightly, that if he loses and withdraws, that he might be overthrown as a result of that. And so for Putin, the stakes may be personal survival, not just win or lose the war, you know, nationally speaking, which would make him even more reluctant to engage in good faith negotiations with the Ukrainian side.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
That's Andrew Kidd. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison, an expert on armed conflict, foreign policy, and nuclear weapons. He's with us today for a look at the latest developments in Russia's war against Ukraine. You can keep following the story there here on the Ideas Network and over at WPR.org. We have reporting there from our colleagues at NPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, is there a bounce back for brick and mortar stores? Find out which retail chains are doing pretty well, even after COVID and competition from online retailers. Let us know if you are happy to go back to stores and shop. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Here's an opportunity for young artists around the state to have their artwork displayed in one of the most unique venues Wisconsin has to offer, the Front Windshield. The state DNR just opened up their call for entries into their annual contest to design the 2023 State Park sticker. They'll get you and your vehicle into parks and forests around the state. I don't have a chance of winning because, one, I have no artistic talent, and, B, this is a contest for high school age artists, so I'm a year or two past that. But if you or someone you know can meet those requirements, head on over to the DNR website for entry info. They suggest a theme of animals, plants, or outdoor activities in Wisconsin. They're taking entries until April 30th, so get drawing and good luck. This is Central Time.